Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Hey, thank you all for joining us on this weekend show. I also hope that you all go back through our website and podcast, kereport.com, or search the KE Report in your podcast provider to find all of our daily editorials and company updates, which we post throughout the week covering market moves, company news, and anything else that we consider important for investors to know, especially when it comes to investing in resources and resource companies. On this weekend show, we're going to start off by talking a lot about the junior sector in terms of resource stocks. We follow a lot of junior companies, and quite frankly, we get most of our questions on junior companies. A lot of these questions asking, what's it going to take to get some of these companies moving? And for some of the standout companies, just how much higher can these run and lead the market? On the back half of the show, we'll go a bit more into some of the charts for broad markets and metals. We are kicking off the show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. We'll post a link in the show notes to the MJG Capital website. Matt, I really want to focus on this one topic you sent over to us, one that we debated and have debated for probably the last couple years here, is the bull and bear case for junior miners in the resource sector. Before we break down the bull case, the bear case, and all the other questions around that, let's just start off with what you consider a junior. Is there a market cap? Is there a certain style of work program? Give us your more definition of what a junior stock is in the resource sector, please.
Sure thing, and good to be joining you, Corey. Hope all's well on your end. Yes, just more definitionally, you'll see juniors from a market cap perspective described as companies that are less than 500 million in market cap. I'll usually use a more liberal definition, so I think anything sub a billion. So if you're looking at it from a market cap perspective, I would say sub a billion. And then really any company that's pre-production or pre-revenue, even if it's a larger development stage company that's valued in the multiple billions of dollars, like we see with Filo Mining, as they're in the midst of their takeout process here, I would also classify that in the junior space. So one way to look at it is for market cap, sub a billion. Another is just whether they're pre-production or not. And if they are pre-production, then I also would lump them into that junior category.
Well, Matt, between the developers and the explorers, a little bit different ballgame in that the developers have already established a resource. They've got some economic studies in place, possibly, and they're moving down that pipeline of de-risking. Whereas on the exploration side, it's really more about drill results. How do you ferret those two out in your own portfolio?
Sure. So I think of the MJG portfolio primarily in five different buckets. The first is prospect generation. We have very heavy weighting towards prospect generation, probably an order of magnitude more, if not multiple order of magnitudes more than your average investor. That's close to 30% of our portfolio right there. Then I look at exploration stage companies, and I would kind of break that category down into two. There's the pre-discovery explorers, and then there's the post-discovery explorers. And the dividing line there is whether there is an economic or potentially economic discovery hole of merit that can make one think, okay, they could be onto something new there. The line blurs a little bit between late stage exploration and early stage development. I would say one could look to the Lassonde curve. And once you kind of hit that first peak in the Lassonde curve where the initial euphoria surrounding a discovery has already played out, you then move into the development phase, which is much more about permitting, obtaining social license, engineering studies, and convincing to the market over the course of a PEA, a pre-feas, and ultimately a feasibility study, if you make it that far, that this project has economic merit and is ultimately worth building. Then you move to the production stage. You know, it could be a single asset or multi-asset producer. We have very little production stage exposure. We only have one name in the portfolio that I would consider a producer. And then that fifth category would be the royalty names. And so in terms of our portfolio, roughly 25% of our weighted portfolio is cash flowing companies, but all of them but one are using the royalty business model. So I think if you have your timing down perfectly in the later stages of bull markets, you can get more leverage with the producers. But if you're investing over multiple cycles and a little less comfortable trying to predict market timing perfectly, I think the royalty business model is a phenomenal way to get exposure to mining production stories.
All right, let's break down the bull and bear cases, but more tied to the stage of company, because in all fairness, look, sub $1 billion market cap, that's probably 90%+ of the resource sector, but you can really break it down, I think, under 500 million and then under even 100 million right now when it comes to exploration and early stage resources. No economics around it, but a company that has done some drilling, let's say they have made a discovery, they've even come out with a resource, but quite frankly, their whole focus is still to grow that resource. What's the bull and bear case for these type of companies?
Well, sure. I think it's important to note that the further you go down the food chain here, the more company and project and management specific the situation becomes. And I think it's important to note, even though the exploration stage juniors, the earlier younger names, will generally perform well in a rising metal price environment, that actually doesn't make logical sense. Many of these companies haven't found anything at the end of the day, and they may be searching for gold. But if you don't have an ounce of gold on hand, then the price of gold going from $1,800 an ounce to $2,500 an ounce, in principle, makes no impact on your actual business. Now, in practice, you do see the valuations of these companies usually get bid up when you do see metal prices run, at least over the medium and long term. But if you actually drill down on the business case, if you have no gold on hand or no copper or no nickel, depending on the given situation, moves in metal prices really shouldn't impact investors' views of these companies. Taking a step back, I would say there's a few data points here that make me more bullish on the juniors more broadly. The first is some data that came out from the TMX Group, the exchange that oversees the TSX Venture and the TSX. They announced this data earlier this month. And they said that in the first half of 2024, we saw $6.8 billion raised by mining issuers of all stripes. So this goes from the very smallest explorers up to the major miners that are listed on these exchanges. And this is the most money raised in the first half of a year for at least a decade, if not ever, according to the TMX Group. And as a point of comparison, the number was $4.2 billion in the first half of 2023. And only $4 billion for all of 2022, compared to the $6.8 that we saw in the first half of this year. So this tells me that the industry is more cashed up than it's been in at least a decade, which means all else equal, less financings and more news flow in the months ahead. And I would argue that this augurs well for share prices. Again, all else equal. Another point, and it doesn't take a genius to understand this, gold is at all-time highs. And even with the point I said, the gold price really shouldn't affect the business case for an exploration stage junior pre-discovery. And in practice, it does. And it helps lower the cost, raise the share price, lower the cost of capital for even the earliest stage of companies. And you guys will know, even though gold is only 15%, I guess at the higher gold price, maybe closer to 20% now, of the value of all the metal pulled out of the ground globally in a given year, just under 50% of juniors on the TSXV are gold-focused. So if there's one metal that's most impactful for the health of the exchange, it's certainly gold. And then I'd also note that gold will typically serve as a bellwether for the rest of the commodity space. This, of course, is not an immutable law of nature. It could very well be different this time. But just look back to 2016, where a massive run in the gold price over the first 9 months of that year signaled the end of what was a incredibly painful and drawn out bear market between 2011 and 2015. And then we saw the same thing repeat post-COVID, where gold and gold equities went on a tear, really from the spring of 2020 through the fall of 2020, which was then followed by a broader-based metals rally throughout 2021 and through the first half of 2022. So gold price is another thing to keep in mind. And then the third, when we discussed this on our last call, the Filo acquisition, that's going to result in $2.8 billion in cash trading hands when that deal closes in the first quarter of 2025. And then since then, we've had the somewhat surprising, I would say, takeout of Osisko Mining by Gold Fields at a really impressive premium. That's going to result in $2.1 billion in cash trading hands when that acquisition closes in Q4 of this year. So between these two deals, we have a cash transfer taking place of just under $5 billion. And that's going to be occurring over the next 180 days. And this is money going in the hands of investors that are positively predisposed to investments in pre-cash flowing mining equities. I should note that both Osisko Mining and Filo had market caps north of that $1 billion metric discussed earlier, but they're both pre-production. So I would still lump them into the junior category myself. And I would argue this is bullish for the space more generally. It's fair to say that most of this capital will go to later stage development companies like the Skeenas and the Ruperts and the Artemis Golds of the world. We saw each of those names spike on the back of the Osisko deal in particular. But there doesn't need to be much of a trickle down into the earlier stage names, the exploration juniors that you mentioned, for it to be highly significant for the space. So yeah, I think the confluence of these factors, the companies being cashed up, gold price at all-time highs, and these massive acquisitions with cash and not shares trading hands, it augurs well for the short term here.
Yeah, Matt, it's going to be nice to see some of that M&A money start to circulate through the sector and maybe find its way into other earlier stage explorers. But to the point you made about the metals price really not affecting the underlying exploration companies because they don't really have a lot of ounces in the ground yet to find, it doesn't really matter if it's gold or silver or copper or nickel, as you say, it's true for all explorers. It really seems to come down to sentiment because we've had so many companies on the show that said, if this news release was released in better sentiment, we'd have gone up double digits, but instead we sold off on the news. So how much does sentiment play into the bullish or bearish thesis in these exploration companies?
I think it plays a huge role. Yeah, and just because I said it doesn't make logical sense doesn't mean that it does not have an impact. Ultimately, this is an extremely capital-intensive business. Whether you're exploring, whether you're drilling out a deposit, whether you're developing it, if you don't have cash flow from other means, you're going to be raising money every step of the way. So cost of capital is crucial. And whether it's logical or not, when metal prices are ripping and investors see that happening, share prices rise and the cost of capital decrease for these companies. So unless in the instance of a very well cashed up company that has multiple years of runway and can answer a few unanswered questions over that period, sentiment's extremely important. And it's up to management to either raise enough money to get off that dilution treadmill every 6 months, or to have some luck and also be very savvy with when they decide to raise capital.
So on this point with raising capital, one thing that we've definitely seen companies separate themselves from the pack in terms of these junior, even micro cap companies, is if they are tied in with some group of companies that have some key wealthy backer. Quite frankly, there's less than probably five that I can think of that have been successful recently raising money and moving projects forward. How important, one, do you find it is to be part of one of these groups that is having current success? And when you look at management, what about advisors? Everyone has advisors that are well known. Do you give them credit for those on their advisory board?
Good questions. I would say from a general sense, it is important to be part of a larger group. I think that bestows credibility on the venture at hand, and also reassures the market that there will be a first check into each financing. One of the hardest steps when you raise money is to get that lead order, is to get that first step. And if you have a Lundin backing or the backing of the discovery group, you can be sure that for most, if not all of your raises, the terms will be set and 40 or 50% of the round will be filled by the time the company actually comes to market and announces that financing. So I think that can be a huge advantage. Understanding that there is the potential for groups to be stretched too thin, and it's important to keep your eye on these groups and make sure that they're not taking too many companies into their stable, because that's one risk of success. You'll see these groups get a little over their skis, take too much onto their plate than they can actually support. In terms of advisors, it's very case specific. I would actually argue if you see more than five advisors associated with a given company, that should actually cause one pause. It's not necessarily a red flag or a true deal breaker right off the bat, but it could indicate that this company's more into promotion than anything. And then you have to look at the specific advisors. Like, there's some really smart, accomplished geological professionals and financial professionals in this industry that frankly advise far too many companies. And if I see their name associated with a company, I view that as a modest negative, because I know there's just not enough hours in the day for said advisor to add any value to the company. and they're more just being used as a name to provide credibility, but just don't have the bandwidth to actually do anything to further the company's cause. And furthermore, if you see 7 or 8 advisors, even if some of them have pretty decent names, that makes clear that there's a lot of advisor shares handed out, likely for free. So you want to see who the advisors are, how many other companies that they're involved with, whether their expertise from their previous ventures are relevant to the task at hand, and also whether said advisors are putting their own money into the company or whether they've just, you know, handed out their name and received advisory shares to their account and then they're on to the next one. So I think all of these are important, and it's incumbent upon investors to either go directly to that advisor and grill them on what their level of involvement is and how busy they are with other obligations. And if they don't have access to that advisor, then demand that manager provide those answers.
Yeah, some great points there, Matt. I think you nailed it, because a lot of companies don't have enough advisors, but there's some that have a handful of advisors. And the question is, why are there so many and how involved are these advisors in the first place? So definitely need to go through and case by case dissect what the role of these teams are and what they're being compensated. I guess to that point, you brought up some great topics at the Rick Rule Private Placement Bootcamp that you just joined, and you were talking to investors about some of the red flags you look for before you'll participate in a private placement. So would you mind sharing a couple of the key red flags you look for where maybe you say no and move on to the next order?
I'd be happy to. I'd first say that was a lot of fun, and it was a very comprehensive discussion over the course of the day of investing in private placements. And there's over 6 hours of content. The material was accessible on replay. So to my understanding, even those that have not signed up can Google Rick Rule Private Placement Bootcamp and can easily sign up and access that content, which is available on demand. My talk was entitled Buyer Beware, When to Pass on a Private Placement. And as you note, it highlighted 15 concrete circumstances that should cause an investor to say no, or at the very least, seriously reconsider a deal, even if other aspects of that deal look good otherwise. On a high level, the points I covered fall under 4 different categories. The first is people. Who else is coming into this deal? Are board and management participating? Are the major shareholders, whether they're institutions or strategics, are they taking their pro rata amount or increasing their stake in the company? Or are they, you know, holding off and not putting another check into the company? Are there groups known for warrant clipping coming into the deal? And is there any evidence of check swaps taking place? These are all things to look at in terms of who else is coming into the deal. The second category is in regards to pricing. Is the pricing of this placement fair and reasonable? And the things to look for there include, how does the pricing of this deal compare to previous financings? Is it at a significant premium to where the company's raised previously? And if there hasn't been a significant catalyst to justify that premium, then why would you put money in at that higher valuation? Was there a big promotional push ahead of the deal? Oftentimes you'll see companies spend a lot of money on marketing right before they announce a financing, and investors that come in are putting their money in at an artificially inflated share price, because unless that promotion is coupled with a real positive fundamental development, the gains are just temporary. Were options granted ahead of the financing at a lower price than where the company is raising money? Are the warrant terms, assuming that warrants are included, are the warrant terms comparable to what investors received in previous deals? These are all different things to consider in terms of the pricing. Third category has to do with timing. Was there a recent financing that occurred within the last 4 months? I.e., are you going to put money into the company only for a month later for a 4-month hold from a previous financing to lift and for there to be selling pressure, driving the share price below the level at which you put money in? Is there a big escrow release coming in the coming months, or the expiration date for a large number of deeply in the money warrants? Are there signs that the company is raising before bad news? This is maybe the most important point. If you're looking at a company and they've raised enough money to accomplish a key catalyst or a key unanswered question, whether that's an economic study or a maiden resource or a drill program, and you're expecting the release of this company changing information, and a month before the expected release, they're raising money, you have to wonder, why is the company raising money at this juncture? They're just 3 weeks away from putting out good news. They would clearly wait to put out that good news, have the share price re-rate, and then raise on the back of that. So that's a really important point to keep in mind. And then kind of the fourth bucket is the use of proceeds. Is this a keep the lights on financing, or is the company actually raising enough money to answer at least one key unanswered question? Will the proceeds go to paying off liabilities, whether that's money due to management or consultants or a big property payment, or whether is it going to go into the ground properly in a drill program or permitting or funding engineering? And the final point would be, will the proceeds go to promotion? I want the company's results to speak for themselves. A little bit of promotion, if it's appropriately timed, is okay. But I couldn't tell you the number of times a CEO has told me, well, just a little promotion here, we're going to be able to get the share price up 2 or 3x from current levels, and then we'll raise, and you'll be deeply in the money. That rarely works when not coupled with a significant catalyst. So those are the points I covered. Obviously, I covered each of them in far more detail. And for those that are interested, I recommend that they look up the private placement bootcamp online, and they can access that information.
So Matt, what are your thoughts on these life financings? They become much more popular. They open up the door for a lot of other type of investors, non-accredited investors, to take part. Shares are free trading right away. Do you like this structure? Do you avoid it? What's your thought on life financings?
Yeah, well, as a U.S.-based fund, we haven't done life financings. I like in principle the idea of taking out the 4-month hold and making markets more efficient and quickly moving. Similar to what we have in Australia, which I would argue is a more efficient structure for juniors raising capital. Of course, the problem with life financings is there's a culture of warrants being included in financings to a much greater degree than what we see in Australia. So the concern that I have with life financings is when there are warrants included, it gives investors that much easier of an opportunity to just clip the warrant and run. So I think life financings coupled with moving away from this culture of warrants is a good combination for Canadian markets. But if warrants continue to be included to the degree that they are, just makes life easier for the warrant clippers out there. And I should argue, I'm not making a moral judgment on warrant clippers. I think that's actually a good strategy to make money, at least over short time periods. But the risk there is once you get a reputation of clipping warrants, it sticks. And you will no longer be invited to participate in the most attractive deals that are out there. So I make a point of when we're investing to look at the company and think to myself, were this company fully cashed up? Is this a management team, a project, a company structure, and a valuation at which I would invest? And if that answer is yes, then it's nice to have a little discount to market. It's nice to have a warrant included. But if the answer is no, then I want no part of that deal, even if it looks very attractive from a warrant or pricing perspective.
Well, Matt, just thinking of warrants, it seems like a lot of the problems companies have building momentum is that they've done a financing previously that has warrants at a certain price. And then when it hits those levels, there are warrant clippers, regardless of what kind of financing it is. And so it really truncates any upside move. And it doesn't seem like other industries do this as much as particular Canadian mining companies. Like if you look at tech companies or if you look at, you know, retail companies, they're not doing financings, giving away the farm on these warrants. And it seems like that creates a lot of the problems in this industry. What's the healthy way a company can use warrants or maybe half warrants or use a discount to market instead of warrants? Where's the balance there?
Yeah, I think that's the answer. Look, if you're invested in a company and they're raising money, you want that management's goal to be to not include warrants in the financing. And if there has to be a discount to market, then make that discount as minimal as possible. I think that's the way to go. There just is a culture of warrants in Canada. And as warrants aren't unheard of in other early stage industries, but they're used to a degree in Canadian resource financings that is greater than any other industry I've seen around the world. But there are companies out there that are able to raise large sums of money without warrants. Those are the groups with the reputation and the access to capital that you generally want to back. So in fact, the last financing that we participated in May was a group that raised basically at market with no warrant. But I thought the opportunity was so compelling between the asset and the management team that was stepping in there that it was an easy decision for me to decide to participate, even though the terms weren't screaming by Canadian junior standards.
All right, Matt, let's move on then. Final couple topic that we'll talk about here is Beaver Creek Conference. It's coming up. It's a conference that we all go to, a lot of one-on-one meetings that happen with companies. You're going to be at Beaver Creek. We're going to be at Beaver Creek. What are you looking to accomplish there?
Well, it'll be good to see you there, Corey. Yeah, and I would just say more generally for conferences, I look to accomplish a few things while I'm there. And I will note this will be a pretty truncated conference due to other obligations. I'm getting in on a Tuesday. I have dinner obligations, two jam-packed days on Wednesday and Thursday, and then I'm out on the Friday. So I'm trying to make the most of the limited time that I have. But the different things I try to accomplish kind of in order of significance, first and foremost is to catch up with our existing investments, get a feel with how things are going, how the company's doing on the working capital front, whether there are any financings that are on the horizon here. And Beaver Creek's going to be excellent in this regard. We have 7 of our 19 positions there. So anytime on one trip, you can catch up with 40% of your portfolio. That's definitely a trip worth taking. Second thing I look to accomplish is to sit down with like-minded investors, and whether that's over dinner, over coffee, over beer, on trading notes, on shared investments, industry trends that we're seeing, industry gossip, which can actually be quite useful. I think the more scuttlebutt you pick up, the better, and it can help inform decision-making going forward. So that'd be the second point, catching up with like-minded investors that I trust and respect. Third point would be to keep tabs on names that are on my watch list. So these are names that we don't own at the moment, but that I could see being added to the portfolio given the right circumstances. And, you know, when I sit down with these groups, you know, getting an update on progress, of course, but also getting a keen sense of whether there's a financing in the near future. And, you know, if so, whether this could be a deal where we set aside some cash in anticipation of that raise. Fourth point would be I try to leave with at least one really compelling new idea from each conference. I know that sounds like a low bar, but even a single compelling idea can make a conference worthwhile. I mean, as mentioned, we only have 19 positions in the portfolio. I'll go to 8 to 9 conferences per year. So that's plenty of new names. If we were to invest in each and one, every one of those compelling ideas, that's more than the turnover we have on an annual basis right there. And then the final point, probably the least significant, something I look to accomplish nonetheless, is promote the fund a little bit. This helps to attract inbound investment opportunities by getting the good word out there, and also has the potential to get the fund in front of new limited partners. We are an open-ended partnership, so we continue to raise money from new investors. So it's good to get out there. And at Beaver Creek, I have a couple interviews scheduled that will be disseminated post-conference. So that will go towards that goal of promoting the fund.
All right. Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. You want to learn more about his fund? Click that link in the show notes. And also feel free to listen to all of our other conversations with Matt that we do on pretty much a monthly basis. Matt, we're looking forward to seeing you in Beaver Creek. Thank you very much for your time on this weekend show. We'll see you soon. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back.